Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and he's an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, and she's an expert in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, guest host Dr. Lindsay Harris is joined by Deborah Collier. Deb is the president of Patient Advocates and Research, otherwise known as PAIR.
Deb, tell us, what is patient advocacy? And tell us, how do you think the field has grown over the last few decades?
Okay. Well, patient advocacy is many different things. And so I usually try to explain the different categories of patient advocacy. Certainly, some of the more traditional approaches are direct patient support and services that are available to people who get cancer or other illnesses. There is also a type of advocacy that focuses on fundraising, and those are either private foundations or funding events that people take part in, like walks and things like that. Another type of patient advocacy deals with political or lobbying advocacy, trying to make things better or push for certain things through Congress and state legislators. Another kind is watchdog advocacy, which is more of what people think about in the AIDS community. But that's where we really bring issues that need to be addressed, put on the table so that there's a light that shines on them and we have to have them discussed and resolved. And then the type of patient advocacy that I focus on is research advocacy, which is actually working with the research community itself, both helping in grant development, grant reviews, but really working with people after they get grants and they need to put them into operation and make progress toward cancer.
So you founded PAIR, Patient Advocates in Research, many years ago now. Can you tell us what is the mission of PAIR and what is the changes in the organization over the time that you've been involved with it?
Okay. Well, PAIR was founded because a lot of people asked me to put a group together that kind of focused on the research part. We have so many wonderful organizations out there that focus on the other types of advocacy that I just mentioned. But the whole purpose for PAIR is that we can throw all the money in the world we want to at cancer research, but if we don't change the way the system works and the mindset of the researchers themselves, we're still not going to make all of the progress and have the impact that we want to have on cancer. And that gets back to part of my personal background, which is in business and computers and organizational development and all of that kind of stuff. But the real mission of PAIR is very simple. It's to get better answers to people more quickly. So in order to do that, there are a lot of, shall we say, opportunities within the research system to do a better job of streamlining and to create a more cohesive process from discovering new scientific areas to develop and then to actually develop those through the process and turn them into something that will work for people in the clinic, both for people that have cancer and those that want to avoid it.
Excellent, excellent. A very important area that hasn't really been focused on in the past. And maybe you could tell us, what are some of the challenges that exist in the current structure of research for cancer, and how have patient advocates tried to meet some of those challenges and help us get over them?
Okay, well, the question would be where to start. There's a lot of areas that need improvement. So, and one example would be what we kind of had coined the phrase for years, tissue issues. Obviously, researchers need tissue to work with so that they can discover what is happening in the cells of cancer patients as well as normal people, so we can start to see what can be done about that. But for some reason, researchers never seem to have the right kind of tissue that they need. So one of the things that we've done is helped with not only sourcing new new areas or new resources for tissue, but also how to explain that to people. What is the value of cancer research, and why is tissue, also called biospecimens, needed? And what can people do to donate it, and what are their risks involved in doing that, so that they can make a good decision about whether that's something they would want to do or not. So consent issues are one of the things that we work on, better ways to explain that to people. Another one is with the collection process itself. Sometimes departments within an institution don't necessarily work well together. And so sometimes we can come in and help sit everybody down and say, okay, why are we doing this in the first place? Let's figure out a better system so that it's a win-win for everyone and that we actually get the tissue that we need. And then it also goes into areas where how is that tissue going to be used? By whom? How can we make sure that it's used well and that any research and discoveries that are made are then put forward so that they can be built upon? So that's one area. Another area is on the research side of clinical trials, which are research studies in people that have to be done before we get new standards of care and new treatments that we know will work. And so there are many ways that we help with that, including developing those clinical trials so that they're very relevant to people's issues as well as important scientific questions that are answered.
That's very helpful to have you explain those issues to us. And clinical trials are a critical part of what Yale Cancer Center is trying to develop in order to improve treatments for cancer patients. But there are many barriers to patient involvement in clinical trials. And can you tell us a little bit about some of those barriers and how patient advocates can help dispel them?
Yes. Well, certainly one barrier is the image. First of all, some people have never even heard about clinical trials and what that really means. And unfortunately, when someone is diagnosed with a life-threatening illness like a cancer or cancers, because there are many different diseases within cancer, that's not a good time to kind of have this thing thrown in front of you, so you have to make a really quick decision about. So I think that there are some ways that we can talk about clinical trials in general so that people understand more about what that means. And for example, one thing that I think people need to understand is that the treatments that exist today for cancer, which have improved quite a bit in the last 20 years or so, exist because clinical trials were done, and there were people who were willing to volunteer to participate in those clinical trials. So that tomorrow's patients will benefit from clinical trials that are done today, so that we find out which drugs or which treatments work better for people than what we already know about.
That's really an important point, I think, is perhaps a lack of understanding that what we use today as standard of care was in a clinical trial yesterday, the day before, a year ago. It may not be apparent to people who are just being introduced to the idea that they may have cancer that clinical trials are really part of the standard treatment of patients.
Right.
You also mentioned to us earlier today when you gave a talk to our group that clinical trials can also benefit the individual patient. And maybe you could elaborate a little bit more on that.
Right. I think one of the things that people sometimes have a misunderstanding about is that there are no choices that someone has in a clinical trial. And there are actually choices that they have. There are always different, in cancer, there are usually different treatment options that are arms or groups of that study. So it's not like they're not going to get any kind of treatment at all. But the other thing that I think is important is that while the ethics community a lot of times will talk about clinical trials and research as being totally experimental and that it's not treatment, in fact, for a cancer patient, that is their treatment. And so we have to think about clinical trials and research studies as a part of treatment options that people can consider. They're not right for everyone, but it's important for people to know that they're out there and that they are possibilities as they're starting to try to make decisions about what they're going to do about their situation. And that includes, by the way, not only people who have cancer, but people who don't have cancer. A lot of studies are done in people that are at maybe higher risk, ways to prevent cancer, ways to screen for it, to diagnose it, as well as early stage cancers. You don't have to be in a dire situation to consider something like that.
Right. And Deb, I think it's important for the audience to realize that you have personal experience with cancer, both yourself and in your family. And you've mentioned to us that you don't know a person who isn't in some way touched by cancer. So can you tell us a little bit more about your personal journey and how that has impacted what you do now?
Right. Well, if I had not had cancer myself, I would not be doing what I'm doing now, which is working with researchers all across the country to try to make their work more timely and effective for people. I had my first breast cancer at age 32, and I was an executive in a computer company at the time. And my boss actually put it in the company newsletter, so it became a very public thing very quickly, which was okay, thank goodness, on my part. But through that experience, I then became involved with an organization when cancer patient advocacy was really just getting started back in the early 90s. And as my husband says, it's this giant, the volunteer world can be a giant sucking sound where your professional life kind of takes a back seat to some of the passion and involvement that was important to let kind of take over. That is not is a very normal experience, by the way, with the patient advocates that get involved in research, or really any of the areas that I mentioned before. People have a personal experience with cancer, either directly themselves or with loved ones, and want to do something to try to help make it better for the next generation, because our kids really should not have to face the same issues that we've had to face. That's not the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah, I think that your experience, your personal experience is, as you say, not unique, and yet you have really made it your mission and have dedicated your life going forward to really trying to help people understand the way that they can change cancers, research strategies, that what people, individuals, patients are, themselves, can bring to the table to really form the way that cancer researchers and cancer doctors impact on the disease. And that's something that is incredibly important. And your dedication has led to your role at the level of the National Cancer Institute on the SPOR programs, to your role in the cooperative group clinical trials organizations, and really have blazoned the way for other patients and patient advocates, family members, and all those touched by cancer to become involved. And so can you tell us a little bit about how the individual patient or their loved one can contribute to trying to make a difference in cancer? It seems, I'm sure, very intimidating to a person who's diagnosed with cancer or whose loved one is. How can I make a difference?
Right. And it can be intimidating. It's certainly not something where you have to become a scientist and know everything, but you do have to educate yourself and really keep going on what are the new concepts in cancer. But one of the key areas that we talk about is just asking, why are things done the way that they're done? Is there a better way? Who else could we be bringing into the conversation? How could we move this forward? What are the barriers that you face? And sometimes there are ways that we can work together to, if not eliminate them, certainly resolve some of the issues so that we get better answers to people more quickly.
And Deb, if people want to contact you either on the web or by email, what number should they use? What email should they use?
Right now I'm between websites, so I don't have one I can give immediately, but my email is fine, and that's my last name, Collyar, C-O-L-L-Y-A-R, at att.net.
Thank you, Deb, and we're going to break for a medical minute. You're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we're here discussing patient advocacy with Deborah Collyar, president of PEAR.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2009, there'll be over 62,000 new cases of melanoma in this country, and about 2,400 patients will be diagnosed here in Connecticut alone. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. But when detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. Clinical trials are underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to newly available medicines which have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lindsay Harris, and I'm joined by Deb Collyar to discuss the importance of patient advocacy in research. Can you tell us a little bit about the program that you started under a national grant? The program is called PART, and what was the goal of that program, that NCI-funded program, and what are you doing with that program now?
Okay. Well, PART stands for Patient Advocate Research Team Program. And the idea was how to, in more of an organized way, bring patient advocates that were interested in the research aspect of things together with the research teams who are actually doing the work so that their discoveries and their research could be informed by both the patient experience, so that that became a part of the dialogue, but also to help learn what barriers were thwarting the research from being able to be translated into results, and what we could do to help with that.
That's great. Can you tell us what sort of initiatives that has led to, and where you're taking that program now?
Okay. Yes, the program actually is moving forward. I talk with different cancer centers and different kinds of cancer programs within institutions a lot, and a lot of people are very excited about it. Some of the things that we were able to do, as I mentioned earlier with the tissue, there are certain projects or certain activities that people can get involved in without having to know a lot about science. Another example of that is a workshop that we set up called Clinical Trials and People, which is meant to bring a good discussion and start a dialogue within different communities with researchers so that we can talk honestly and directly about what clinical trials are about, what research is about, what researchers need to know about various communities. And by that, I mean it could be ethnic communities, racial, it could be older citizens, all the different groups that may or may not have good representation in clinical trials or within the medical system even. But the idea there is to not only talk about it and to explain a little bit more about research, but also for researchers to hear about what community needs are and what patient needs are. And at the end of this workshop, the thing that's really exciting about it is that people are able to talk about an informed consent together, which explains the research, but the community members can also talk about how that explanation and how that research can be done in better ways that meet the needs of their community. So it immediately sets up a relationship and a way to continue discussion. So that's one example.
That's a great example, Deb. And as the director for the Office for Elimination of Cancer Disparities at the Yale Cancer Center, I have had a number of conversations with community leaders about how we can reduce cancer disparities. And by that, I mean We know that some groups in this country and in the world do not fare as well after a diagnosis of cancer, and we're starting to understand what some of those reasons are. They appear to range from the nature of the tumors that develop in different populations of people to access to good medical care and to cultural barriers. So in your program, maybe you could give us an example of a way that you've tried to break down some of those barriers in using the PART program.
Well, I think to begin with, it's important to discuss issues and past atrocities, frankly, especially to certain populations, that have been done in a very frank and open, direct way. The fact is, none of us like the fact that some of those things have been done. And there are more protections in place today, and it's important for people to know what that's about as well, but also to know that they can have a voice in the way research is done. Getting there sometimes is the issue, which is another part of what the PART program tried to do, was give training and resources and kind of a communication network together for people that were interested in getting together with researchers. But the main thing is that what I find, anyway, is when we talk honestly about research, both the issues and problems as well as the potential for it, people are very receptive to that. And if they feel that they can play a part in that and have input into the process, it solves a lot of the problems.
So, in your experience with the Indian tribes in Arizona, for example, mm-hmm. Maybe you could tell us how that meeting really led to some really significant changes in the way the research was being done at that cancer center. And you know, as an example of how these sorts of initiatives can really make a big difference and change the future.
Okay. Well, as an example, with the University of Arizona and their what they call their GI spore, which is the gastrointestinal, it's the colon cancer primarily group, they were interested in conducting this workshop, and we invited 9 different American Indian tribes. It was a team effort to put the workshop together with the university, with my program, and with the American Indian Oncology Program, which had worked with tribes. In doing so, we had these sessions both on research and what research studies were about, but we also had presentations from the community on what researchers needed to know about them. So it was a dialogue. And we actually, the result of that workshop was that we were able to interest one person into becoming a patient advocate with that research team, which was our goal. And so she now attends research meetings, gives input into the process, finds out what kind of problems are going on, and really gives a good perspective from the people that she represents, her tribe. And another result from that was another member of a different tribe who helped bring in the university's information service, the Cancer Information Service, to start a whole cancer education program that was, again, a two-way dialogue so that there was learning on both sides of the fence.
And that is, I think, a wonderful example of how just sitting at the table together with the invested parties can really accomplish so much in the long run, that eventually increased understanding of what the researchers are doing and what the patient's needs are can only serve to improve the ultimate outcome for both the people doing the research, who need to understand what the value is of what they're doing, and the individuals receiving the results of that research, who really want to see that those apply to their own population. It's another unfortunate gap that exists not only between different socioeconomic, different racial groups in this country, but also between patients and researchers. There's, in fact, a large gap that we... I think we really need to address, and the term that's coined is translational research, which attempts to translate results from the bench to the bedside and the reverse. So tell me, how do you think that the patient advocates and representatives really play a role in that, in bridging that gap?
Okay. Well, and of course, translational research is bench to bedside, which is a term that's used a lot. But what that really means is taking basic science discoveries and then figuring out how to actually apply those to people in ways that can be tested well and carefully so that we can actually have new treatments and answers, perhaps risk profiles and stuff like that for people. And I think... You know, part of what we have to discuss here in this particular area is that there are research cultures within institutions that also are not necessarily set up to help foster translational research. So sometimes, as a patient advocate, we'll get involved not only with the researcher, but also with some of the systems that have evolved within an institution that aren't helping us get results. Because a lot of institutions are, and actually academic universities, are set up to build knowledge, but not necessarily set up to get results. And so it's changing some of the culture within those institutions. And we do that through a variety of ways. Sometimes it's talks like I gave this morning. Sometimes it's actually getting involved in a specific program. Sometimes it's talking with the institutional review boards that look at research and review it for human risk. And sometimes... maybe go a little bit overboard in trying to protect people, but don't allow the research to actually take place to get the answers that we all would like to have. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Absolutely, and I think that that it's really important that patients and families understand that we look forward to and appreciate their input, and. For those individuals or groups who would like to become more involved in the research that's going on here at Yale, either in cancer disparities or any other specific type of cancer, feel free to call us at 1-888-234-4YCC and ask to speak to myself or leave a message for our groups. If they would like to email their questions, we would be more than happy to address them. It's really critical that patients and consumers of medical care become more involved in the outcomes of the research and really influence what happens at the level of the cancer center.
I agree with that, Lindsay. And just as one last point, I think it's incredibly important, and that patient advocates can play a role in that, in helping to tie excellent research institutions such as Yale together with community practices and community clinics where people are being treated regularly. Because, again, cultural differences sometimes can get in the way of cooperation and coordination. And the type of research that needs to be done has to be done in a collaborative way now. There's no one group or one person or institution or even company that can get the answers that we need as we get move toward personalized medicine.
That's a really great point, Deb. I think just to wrap up, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on today's program. The information you've given us is incredibly helpful. And again, just to emphasize, for anyone who wants to contact Deb, Deb, can you remind us your email?
Sure. collyar@att.net. And thank you very much for asking me to participate in this. I'm very honored to be here.
great pleasure to have you come. And do feel free to contact me at Lindsay Harris, the head of the Office for Elimination of Cancer Disparities and the Breast Program at Yale Cancer Center at 1-888-234-4YCC if you want to become involved.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.